MacCast, Monday, December 31st, 2012. Hey, Mac Geeks, it's time for your MacCast, the show for Mac Geeks by Mac Geeks. I'm Adam, and this is the show where we discuss all things Macintosh. How you doing? Welcome back to the MacCast. Well, this was intended to be the last MacCast for 2012. I was doing the show prep and getting things ready to go on the 31st, but as can happen, it took a little bit longer than expected, and I had to shuffle off to New Year's festivities with family and friends. And so I hope you did something similar and had a great New Year. I'm actually recording this then on January 1st in the new year. So we're able to add on an extra little story, which came out if you woke up this morning and suddenly realized that your iOS devices were being quieter than expected, especially if you use the Do Not Disturb feature. I'll let you know what's going on with that. So we have that story, a bunch of other great stories from the end of the year, a lot of rumors and speculation about what Apple might be up to in the coming year, when we might see new iPads, when we might see those US-made Macs, and which ones Apple actually is that going to be producing here in the US. So got all those stories to get into. Also, a great conversation that I had with friend of the show, George Starcher. He came on, and we talked about a situation he had recently to use the backups that we're always saying you should make. So we're going to make a case for why these things come in handy, and it's always fun talking with George. So stay tuned for all of that. But before we get into it, I do want to take a quick moment and thank one of our show sponsors. That's Circus Ponies, makers of Notebook. You know, we're moving into the new year. If you're looking to get better organized, Notebook can be something that can really help you out. You can keep all of your projects, the notes, the files related to what you're working on, all of the information in a single Notebook file within the Notebook application. Get organized with all that stuff. You can do things like add lists and to-do items, and those can even sync in with your calendar. You can also link in emails and correspondence with people that you're working on the project with, and throw in contact information, and that's all accessible right from within inside your notebook. You don't even have to leave the application to get access to that additional information. So you kind of collate it. It works very much like you would be working with a physical notebook. It's just a digital form, and it's a great piece of software. On top of that, you can do things like add flags for important items. You can throw in sticky notes to add on additional information. Take those off. So if you just need to jot a little quick side note on something you're working on, you can do that in a sticky note and it'll be right there. And plus, all of that stuff gets indexed using their multi-dex feature. So it gets indexed in multiple ways and makes it really easy to search and get right at the information you're looking for when you need it. It's really just one of those programs that's really handy to have around, have a copy on your Mac. You can try it out free for 30 days, but better yet, just buy yourself a copy. You're not going to be sad that you did. And head over to circusponies.com now. You can get all the details and pick up your copy. And a big thank you to Circus Ponies for their continued support of the MacCast. So as I was mentioning at the top of the show, there is a lot of speculation on what Apple might be up to in the coming year. And kicking off the news for this week, there is a story that started surfacing and swirling around about a week or so ago. Actually, this one's been around for a while, but it started picking up steam about a week or so ago. And that was that Apple is working on an iWatch, a device that you would wear on your wrist and it would interface via Bluetooth with your other iOS devices. If you remember, Apple redesigned the iPod Nano, and it took away actually one of the popular aftermarket hacks for that, and that was using the device not only as a music player, but as a tiny watch that you could wear on your wrist. And there were all kinds of cases from different manufacturers, ranging from, you know, really simple to really elaborate stylized designs, and a lot of people really liked it. And Apple even started championing the idea in their keynotes. They made customizable watch faces for the device so you could swap out different faces on it. And they kind of got into the whole thing, and then they up and redesigned the iPod Nano in this last generation, went back to the longer, taller, slimmer form factor. Well, I don't know if it's slimmer. It might be thinner, But the point is that you can no longer fit it into a watch case. And Apple's always played around with the size and sort of shape of the Nano. So now, according to a Chinese blog, they're saying that Apple and Intel might be actually working specifically on a smartwatch-style device. The rumors claim it's going to be a Bluetooth device with a 1.5-inch OLED screen. Didn't mention if it would be a touchscreen or not, but I assume that it would be. There wasn't a lot of detail on what the functionality would be, but the report does mention that Siri support would be in there, and it likely would have tight integration with the iPhone, allowing you to make phone calls from the watch. That one, you know, that seems to play out these Dick Tracy fantasies that a lot of people have. I'm not really sure how much appeal I would see in sort of talking into my watch versus just taking my phone out of my pocket and talking into that. It almost falls in line with using a Bluetooth headset, which I think is even more convenient than sort of talking into your watch. But that's one of the rumors that's out there. I think more to the point, though, would be some sort of functionality that would offer a mini notification center that would sit on your wrist. So you'd have your watch there, and as notifications came in, you could set up and customize it to see certain bits of information displayed on your watch. So rather than having to pull your phone out of your pocket, you could just simply look down at your wrist and get information on weather, maybe news items that you want to follow on, text and email updates, as well as all of your social media notifications from things like Twitter and Facebook and Instagram. And then you can kind of decide, hey, do I need to grab my phone and interact more with this, or can I just kind of get a little update, quick one or two line update? And there's been a lot of interest in sort of this style of device over the past year. Apple could be at this point just really mulling over the concept, considering this type of device, because Sony's coming out with these types of products. Also, the announced Pebble e-ink smart watch that was released on Kickstarter, that hasn't been shipped yet, but very popular, I think one of the most popular Kickstarter campaigns of the past year, and generated a lot of money and a lot of interest. So this idea of linking a smart watch into your other devices, having sort of this little wearable notification center and information center, is something that's interesting. And obviously, based on the rumors, seems like something that Apple might be looking into. So will we see an iWatch? They're saying in the first part of the year that Apple might be shipping it to sort of fill in the hole where they normally would be announcing an iPad. I kind of waffle on that rumor too, because there's still a lot of speculation, as you're going to hear in a moment, that Apple might have a new iPod or iPad in the works, coming in the first half of this year. I think that could happen. But more to the point with the iWatch, if you've been holding off and waiting to see if Apple will do a watch type product, that's gaining some traction as well. So maybe we'll see that from Apple, along with the much rumored TV product. Who knows? It's going to be an interesting year for sure, and I think we will see Apple branching out in some way more into that consumer electronics space. Will it be an iWatch? I don't know. Let me know what you think. Back to the iPad rumors, though. We talked on the last couple episodes that there is speculation Apple is getting ready to do another update to the iPads. Seems like sooner than we would think, but Apple may be moving to this bi-yearly release cycle. We already talked about a potential Retina version of the iPad mini and updates to the new iPad to bring it more in line with the design styling of the current products, the iPhone 5 and the iPad mini. So using the black back on the black models and moving to more of those design cues, making it thinner and maybe even lighter. And something that may help Apple do that is the latest rumors we're hearing, which is speculation that Apple is looking to partner more closely with Sharp for their next generation iPad displays. And there's, I think, two possible and very good reasons why Apple may want to move display production over to Sharp technology. One would be further distancing themselves from Samsung. We know there's been no love lost between Samsung and Apple over the past year. And the second reason would be that Sharp has their IGZO, that's the indium gallium zinc oxide display technology that we've heard about over the past year. Sharp has struggled with that a little bit, but the point of that technology is it's a display that requires less backlighting, which means it could allow for thinner and more power-efficient designs for Apple, something that they're always looking to do. So they have that, plus a bonus for Apple could be that Sharp has been struggling lately financially, and Apple could get a pretty good deal giving Sharp a big contract. They have incentive to kind of work with Apple to try and, you know, gain some of that business. And so it could be a potential win for both companies. And Sharp has supposedly already licensed the IGZO technology to Intelux Corporation and is reportedly looking to license the technology to AU Optronics. Both of those companies have operated as Apple suppliers in the past. Now, we had been hearing rumors over the past year that Apple was looking to move to the IGZO technology, but a big problem, I guess, has been the yield. Sharp just hasn't been able to produce the quantity of displays. That may be another reason why they're looking to partner and license the technology to some other suppliers so maybe they can get production levels up. And so that means this rumor at this point is still just a rumor. It doesn't appear to be a certain thing. The licensing certainly shows the possibility, but at this point, I think Apple is probably just testing the waters. They want to see if the technology is going to fit their needs and their demands. I know there's some differences between the current IPS and IGZO technologies. They both have advantages and disadvantages, so Apple's going to have to weigh those for what they want to do with future iPads. There's also a possibility that they're just looking to make sure that Sharp and the other licensees and the IGZO display technology can meet their standards and also meet those yields that they're going to need for future products. And I'm sure that's a concern, knowing that that was an issue in the past. I think for sure, though, that Apple wants to continue to cut Samsung out of the picture, and this could be a big step forward in that direction. So we'll have to wait and see till those new iPads come out. And I guess the big question there is, will we see them in the first half of this year, or will it be the second half of the year? And only Apple, I think, probably knows the answer to that question at this point. There's probably very little debate that this past year was certainly the year of the tablet. We as Apple owners and iPad owners have had tablets in our lives for a while, but until the past year, there's been kind of this slow build of Android tablets and competitors. But this year, we saw some really strong competitors hit the market in the Android space. I'm thinking of things like the Kindle Fire, the Samsung Galaxy tablets, as well as the Google Nexus tablets. They released multiple sizes, larger versions, and so it definitely the competition heated up to the point where we're almost at a 50-50 split. Android devices continued to kind of chip away at the iPad's dominant market share. But something else interesting happened this past year, and that was firms and people started looking at how people are using tablet devices, and it seems to be shaping up that iPad owners use their devices in very different ways from Android owners. And it was supported this week by some numbers and information that came out from the ad firm Chitika. They looked at usage numbers on iPads on tablet devices, between December 8th and December 14th of this year, and found that at least for web traffic, iPads accounted for 87% of the traffic. And the next closest tablet was the Kindle Fire with 4.25%, followed by the Galaxy tablets from Samsung with 2.65%, and then Google Nexus tablets at 1.06%. So at least for web surfing, iPads still seem to be the dominant tablet by a wide margin. And that got me kind of thinking, why is that? I would imagine that over the holiday season, we saw even more Android tablets hitting the market, and Android may have even moved into a majority market share over the iPad, at least for the holiday season, if not permanently, with all of these new lower-cost, lower-priced Android devices sort of hitting the market and being given as gifts over the holiday season. Chitika says they're going to update their numbers for post-holiday, so we'll have to see how those work out. But it certainly does seem to indicate that there is a different usage pattern, or there may be something else going on. I can honestly tell you that I have never set up an Android tablet from scratch. I've only ever worked with iPads, but I know of at least two Apple owners who tried to help their relatives this holiday season set up different Android devices, and they both found that the experience was very negative. It was not an easy experience. I think in one case, somebody mentioned having to register 3 separate accounts, a Google account, as well as an account with, I believe, Samsung, and some other account just to get that tablet online. And it made me kind of speculate that maybe what's going on with Android devices is a lot of people are picking them up for family members, for relatives, and it might be more technical, nerdy people buying an Android device. But then when that out-of-the-box experience happens, it's a negative experience, and it becomes this device that people just don't know what to do with or don't want to deal with. I find that hard to believe. I don't think that they're that difficult to set up. But does that out-of-box experience factor into this whole debate? I think probably more likely what's going on, though, is it's just a different way of looking at the devices, where many iPads, I think, are being used almost as PC or Mac replacements, or at least supplements. I think a lot of the lower priced Android devices are becoming more dedicated devices, and it's likely because of the lower price point. So you might take your Android tablet, say it's a Kindle Fire, and you're really picking that up to be purely an ebook reader, or maybe a media player, or a gaming machine. And I think the same thing could be happening with the Galaxy Tabs as well as the Samsung tablets, and that people just aren't using those devices for web surfing. And that would explain the discrepancy in the Chitika numbers versus just the number of units of devices that are being sold out there. Chitika's only looking at web surfing numbers. And I think that Android devices are being used. I think they're just being used more offline or for more dedicated and specific tasks. But I don't know, I could be wrong. Is it just that they're sitting completely idle? I find that very hard to believe that someone's going to get these really nice new devices. And I do believe that Android is a good, viable platform. I don't think it's like inherently flawed or broken. I think they're good devices, and I think most people would be happy to get an Android tablet for the holidays. But, you know, the question begs, why aren't people using them in the same way? And so, again, just purely speculating here, but I'd be curious to know what you think on the topic. Another big story for 2012 was Apple's announcement that they would be bringing production of at least one Macintosh to the U.S. in 2013. It was actually a statement that Tim Cook made on his NBC interview a couple weeks ago, and there was a lot of speculation following that interview as to which product or which Mac Apple would be producing in the States. We even saw that some of the new iMac models had a Made in America label on them, and there was some speculation that it could be the iMac, or at least that Apple was testing out some U.S. production with a few of the iMacs. And I don't think the iMac is the model that Apple was going to produce here, but there was a lot of speculation that it might be the new Mac Pro machine. Tim Cook had said and sent out an email to a customer who is concerned about the future of the Mac Pro line, saying that we will have a new Pro model coming in 2013. And it seemed to make sense that that could be a model that Apple could move into U.S. production with. It has a little lower demand, and it would give them time to work out some processes. But now this week, we're hearing reports that it may be the Mac Mini getting the Made in America label. The speculation comes from Digitimes, who has been hit or miss on Apple rumors in the past, but they do occasionally get stuff right. And they're pointing to both Foxconn and Quanta Computer, who have facilities in the U.S., have manufacturing facilities already in the U.S., and they're saying that those could be potential partners for Apple to produce Macs in the States. And Digitimes is reporting that it would be the Mac Mini moving into U.S. production, and that does seem to fit the same bill as the Mac Pro would have, as being a starting point that Apple could work from in terms of getting into U.S. production of at least some Macs. It has a lower volume. It's believed that Apple shipped about 1.4 million Mac Minis in 2012, and that was actually an increase over the prior year of about 40%. So the iPad Mini's growing, but it's not huge. It's not unmanageable in terms of units, and Apple's actually hoping to ship another 30% or increased shipments of Mac Minis another 30% in 2013. And the simpler design of the Mac Mini could mean that they could automate more of the manufacturing steps. They're still going to need workers to help manufacture those machines, but it's believed that if Apple moves into U.S. production, that production is going to be a bit more automated than what they do over in China. And I think the Mini could provide a really good platform for Apple to test U.S. production and give Apple and its manufacturing partners time to work out new procedures and new techniques that are going to be needed for successful production of Macs in the U.S. And starting with one of their lower demand product lines is going to give them that ability. The process also would allow Apple to see if production in the States is feasible, if they can move other production operations back to the U.S. or at the very least start adding U.S. facilities to help with the production and the demand of their factories that are already in China and Brazil. And using something like the Mini, I think there's going to be a lot of eyes on Apple. I think they're going to want to be very deliberate and careful about how they move into U.S. production. They're going to want to make sure that they succeed so they can set this example that they want to set for other manufacturers. And using a product line like the Mini or the Mac Pro just makes a lot of sense and seems to make that a possibility. And then finally, I think the big question for 2013 is going to be, is this the year that Apple moves into the consumer television space? Is the television the next battlefield for Apple and Samsung? We're already getting rumors. They're getting close to CES is coming up here in the next week. Samsung has been teasing that they have a big change coming in the TV market. They're going to announce something to shake up the HDTV market at CES next week. This actually came from one of their Korean blogs. They posted this sort of surreal image of this panel, interestingly enough, in portrait mode with an image of a tree. It was kind of on this desolate landscape, very odd, kind of surreal image. And they added some teaser text that simply said, "A true innovation in television design is coming with unprecedented new TV shape and timeless design." And it's that new TV shape that seems a little bit odd. There was a lot of speculation because the image almost looks like it's transparent or kind of like a window, that it's going to be one of these glass televisions that has a see-through capability. I that's something that's like this sci-fi thing that comes from things like Minority Report and a lot of stuff we see on TV. I don't know if I want to see through my TV. The images never look that good to me. It's like you're looking at a ghost image constantly. So I don't know if it would sort of brighten up and become opaque when you're actually watching television, and then you could kind of have translucent smart TV alerts and information up there and actually see through it when it's not in use. That always seems like this weird thing. But there was kind of no other info given in this little teaser, and so there's a lot of speculation going on. Another thing that's being speculated about is this going to be a portrait mode television, which also makes almost no sense, but certainly fits in with the teaser saying that it's going to be this unprecedented new shape, although I think it more alludes to the fact that it's going to be really super thin, just a very, very thin panel. TechCrunch is also reporting that Intel is looking to get into the television game in a much bigger way in 2012. They're saying that Intel's been frustrated with getting manufacturers to put their chips into their new smart TV products. They're also saying that Intel hasn't been impressed with stuff like the Google TV, a lot of the smart TV technology that's out there on the market. And that what they're planning to do is to release a set-top box driven by Intel technology along with a new companion virtual cable TV service. The report says that they are going to get over some of the content licensing hurdles by rolling out city by city rather than trying to go nationwide all at once, so they can kind of work with different markets and maybe convince different providers that it's going to be a small test bed and get them comfortable with the idea and then roll out to more and more cities as the product and services kind of gain steam. They're also saying that it's going to provide both broadcast channels as well as streaming content, and that it would allow you to watch any subscribed broadcast programs aired over the past month, so potentially reducing or even eliminating the need for DVR-like functionality in a set-top box. Now, we know that there have been rumors for years now that Apple's looking to introduce their own television product, that Apple's going to produce an HD TV, and many feel that this might be the year that Apple gets into that market as well. I think what's interesting here is to think that Apple and Intel could potentially partner to make that happen. If Intel's getting into the TV space, Apple's already been dabbling in the TV space with the Apple TV and is rumored to be looking to get in more heavily. They have been partners, you know, in many other areas of their business in the past, specifically in chips. And so it could happen that Apple and Intel do this thing together. I think that seems very unlikely at this point because Apple really seems more interested in doing their own chip designs. And from the TechCrunch report, it seems like what Intel's really trying to do is get their chips into a set-top box or into a product and get their piece of the television pie. So those two things seem to conflict. But there's also been these rumors that a big struggle for Apple has been getting the content deals done, getting access to the content they need. So if Intel starts to make headway down that path, I think we could see a point where Apple looks to Intel to maybe partnership on the content side, get some of Intel technology into Apple's set-top box and maybe use Intel chips in that way. And it could provide a very interesting path and be beneficial for both companies. I don't know that that would happen. I'm just speculating it's something that could happen. But I think the one thing that Apple has been looking at very, very hard and that Intel is coming to realize too is that this is really a content problem. And I know I've kind of talked about this on the show in the past, but I really think that this is where the issue is. And this week, a report from NPD seemed to also back me up on that. They said that currently smart TV manufacturers, companies like Samsung, who are building in all these apps and all this extra functionality into TVs, might be barking up the wrong tree. They found that consumers don't want a bunch of extra stuff and features added to their television. They're not looking for social networking, getting Twitter updates, voice control. All of these things tend to add more complexity to the TV. And what consumers are really looking for is simpler access to content. They want more content. They want more on-demand and streaming-type access to things. So that's why I think we've seen the popularity of Netflix and Hulu and now the new Redbox service that we're hearing about coming on board, because they're offering the content that people want. The biggest problem with a lot of those services is that you can't get access to all of the content that you want. So while the method for getting that is what people desire. I mean, I love Netflix. It's like awesome, but isn't the biggest problem is that you go in there and you can't find all of the TV shows that you want, or that the content is really fragmented. So you have to get some of it from Hulu, some of it from the ABC app, some of it from the PBS app, and it's all there, but you have to do a lot of digging and searching and finding. And I think what people are really looking for in a next generation television product, and I really believe this is the thing that Steve Jobs alluded to when he said, hey, we've cracked what this problem is that people just want a device, a place that they can go do a simple search and say, I'm looking for this show, and have it pop up and get instant access to that. Now, the thing that they're going to have to figure out is, how do you get that content deal? How do you do the revenue share? How do you pay for that? How do you give consumers what they want at a reasonable price? And that's a big, big challenge. But again, if Intel can make some headway in that respect and Apple can kind of ride along with them, that could be a good thing for all of us. So we'll just have to see. But certainly, I think 2013 is going to be the year where we see some big changes in the television side of the consumer electronics industry. And I think Apple will be a part of that, at least in some way. The question is, how big a part is Apple going to play at this point? And is it going to be another year, 2014, before we see Apple really jump in? I think they're being cautiously optimistic. And I think that's why we did see the little update in Tim Cook's perspective on moving Apple TV from a hobby to an area of intense interest. So how intense is it going to be? I think only time will tell. But that's going to do it for the news for this week. Last week, I had a listener who had emailed me, and he was looking for a way to save Instagram photos. And more specifically, he had friends who would post photos that he would like, and he wanted to save copies of those and wanted to know a process for doing that. And I looked into it and found that it wasn't very easy. If you go back and listen to that episode, I did have a sort of workaround, but it was pretty convoluted. And I think specifically he was looking for a way to save images from his iOS device, and I couldn't find a way to do that directly, at least beyond just taking a quick snapshot or a screenshot on the iOS device and saving it out that way. But that gives you kind of a low-res version of that image. If you want to get the largest copy, which with Instagram, it isn't even that large. I think it's 612 by 612 pixels or something like that. But if you want to get the full image that was posted to Instagram, it was kind of this convoluted process that I had worked out. And I asked you if you could suggest maybe alternate ways or better ways of doing that. And I did get some feedback on that. But before I let you know that solution, I also want to mention that I did get an email from a listener, Steve, who makes his living shooting photography. And I believe he uses Instagram as well. And he brought up an excellent reminder that I should have mentioned in the last show. And that is surrounding copyright and just ownership of those photos. And it's important to remember that I think one of the reasons why Instagram makes it a little bit difficult to just save off an image from another user is that those photos are owned by the person who shot them. And in a way, Instagram is kind of protecting the copyrights of that owner by not making it really easy for you to save your own copies. So the important thing to remember here is that the tips I'm providing aren't meant for you to go grab somebody's photos and then use those in a project or throw them up on your website that you're designing and use them. That kind of usage is not permitted under copyright. You need to get permission. So you would need to email that person, ask them for permission. And if you were able to do that, you should be able to get them to send you the original photo that they shot from their phone. So that would be kind of the best way to get it if you were planning on using it for that sort of purpose, or if you wanted to reprint those images, something like that. But if your plan is, hey, my friend posted an Instagram photo, I really like that photo, I just want to use it for my own personal use, or I want to keep a copy so that I can come back and look at it later, I don't have to go searching for it on Instagram, then that probably is okay. I think technically that may still be a violation of copyright. I'm not a copyright attorney, but I don't see a lot of harm in doing that. So if that's your intent in sort of saving these images just for personal use, I think that me giving you some ways to do that is likely okay. But just be considerate of the person's rights if you're grabbing those photos. And I think Will Wheaton has a great saying. I'm going to give you a more safe for work version of it, but it amounts to don't be a jerk. And that can be good for life in general, but definitely when you're dealing with social media and you're online, don't be a jerk. Don't steal someone's images and use them for your own profit and gain. You know, if it's just to enjoy looking at the image, I think the original poster's not going to mind too much about that. So to that end, Donald sent me a great alternative tip for easily saving your Instagram images that you might like, but it does require a couple bits of technology, having accounts on a couple different services. One would be a Dropbox account, which I think a lot of us have. I am a big fan of Dropbox. But then the other thing to add to this solution is an account from If This Then That. And if you haven't heard of If This Then That, it's a great service that kind of lets you mash up other services and automate different processes. It's kind of hard to wrap your head around. I think the best way to understand it is to go to the If This Then That website, ifttt.com. Check out what they have to offer. They have videos and information, and also you can see the kind of services that it integrates with. But basically, it lets you take one service and integrate that with another service. And so in this case, what you would do is you'd get into your If This Then That account, and they have you create these things called recipes, and they kind of walk you through the process of setting them up. So what you'll do is you'll create a new If This Then That recipe, and you'll choose Instagram as the if. So you say, if Instagram, if I do some sort of action on Instagram, like a new photo, basically clicking the like button, then that will do something to another service. In this case, what we're going to do is we're going to save that image into your Dropbox account. And it may be obvious, but you will need to authenticate the if this, then that service with the different services you want to integrate with. So you're going to have to give it access to your Instagram account. You're going to have to give it access to your Dropbox account. So just be aware of that in case you might be uncomfortable about that. But I've been using the service, and I know a number of people who have been using the service for different kinds of solutions for years, and it's great. There's a lot of power contained in this. So what you're going to do is you're going to create these different recipes. And in this case, the recipe that Donald sent me goes like this. You're going to create a new if this, then that recipe. And for the if part, you're going to pick Instagram as the source. And for the trigger, you're going to select new liked photo. And you'll click create trigger at that point. And then you'll be presented with the that portion. And for that, you're going to choose Dropbox. And for the Dropbox, or for the that action, you're going to choose add file from URL. And then set the path to your Dropbox account, where you want the image to be saved in your Dropbox account. And you'll create the action. And then so once it's all set up, the way this will work is the if this, then that recipe will watch your Instagram account, and anytime you like a new image from any place, it will kick in and it will go to the URL for that image. It will grab it and will save a copy of that image right into your Dropbox folder. It's really that simple. And what I love about Donald's solution, beyond it being just so simple, is that unlike my solution, it can work entirely from your iOS device, because you just go into the Instagram application, like a photo. And then in the background, if this, then that is going to go ahead and grab a copy, put that into your Dropbox account. And if you have Dropbox on your iOS device, you can go into Dropbox just a few minutes later and you're going to see that image there. And then from Dropbox, you could add that right into, say, your camera roll and get it right on your device. So I want to thank both Steve and Don for their feedback on that one. And if you have another suggestion, another method for doing this, let us know. Send me some feedback at maccast@gmail.com. I wanted to mention a quick product announcement or story I saw this week that I thought was very interesting. Amazon is now apparently selling lightning cables for iOS devices. If you remember when Apple announced the new lightning connector, they were the only ones making cables. And part of the reason for that was Apple had not released the specifications or information to third-party manufacturers on how to get the made for iPhone certification on the new connector and the new cables. Well, that was resolved, I think, about a month or so ago. And apparently Amazon is now in their Amazon Basics line selling a 3-meter lightning charge and sync cable for just $14.99 US. So a little bit cheaper than Apple's $20 cable. You can save a little bit of money, and it comes from Amazon. So I would imagine that it's a pretty good cable. You can find a link to the product in the show notes at maccast.com if you want to check it out. So you know that I hound you about doing backup. As a matter of fact, I just did a MacCast member show about sort of prepping for the coming year and a number of steps that you could do to get your Mac ready. And the first and foremost item that I had on my list was either start doing backup if you haven't started yet, or at least add to or analyze and look at your backup scheme and see if you can make it better and improve upon it. And for that episode, I invited George Starcher on to kind of talk to us about some of the concepts and stuff like that. And during that segment, he actually told me that, hey, you know what? This paid off for me. I had a reason to use my backup this last month, and we wanted to share that information with you. So I invited George to come on the MacCast and just kind of run us through exactly what happened and why it's so beneficial to make sure that you have a good backup strategy. So here's my conversation with George. Hey, George, how you doing?
Hey, doing all right. Just got out of The Hobbit with my niece.
Nice.
Yep, yeah, all my friends had seen it, and so she took pity on me and went with me.
I still have to go see that. Been too busy. But I guess we're going to do a little reprise of something we did for the member show. Because, you know, we're here at the end of the year, and I did a whole sequence with you on sort of maintenance and cleanup and getting your Mac ready for the end of the year. And as part of that whole conversation, we, as people can probably figure out, talked about backup as being one of the first things that you should be either starting up or maybe reevaluating and adding to. And as part of that conversation, you had told me that you recently had occasion to use your backup.
Yes.
And more importantly,
yes. this is all about telling everyone, you know, we, at past shows, you've done it, and other shows I've done, and other podcast stuff, we always say backup, 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 backup. This is a firsthand account of how it saved my butt, and it went perfectly painlessly and smoothly because I was properly prepared and doing what I preached.
Right, right. And then I guess the side thing to this, you know, beyond just backup and having it and why it comes in handy is just a general experience of using Apple's built-in methods for actually recovering and how well it actually does work.
Yes, yes.
So you want to let folks know what happened?
Okay, so just to give you a little bit of background first, I've been having some intermittent problems with my iMac. It is a 2007, so it's about 5 years old, which, you know, is about the age for hard drives and stuff to start having issues. But specifically the issue I had an older Drobo I kind of inherited from a friend. I loaded it up with drives. I keep it attached by FireWire 800. Periodically, the unit, for lack of a better term, crashes and locks up Finder. And thus, OS 10 tends to lock up when that happens. It's why now I just copy data to it rather than actually like trying to run my library from it or my virtual machines from it. I just use it as a backup destination. Right. So I'm using like ChronoSync to back up my iTunes library to it every week to make sure it stays, you know, synced to an extra place. But what was happening was when it locked up like that, I really had no way to recover. And since I wasn't here a lot, I go around for work a lot, so I wasn't always at my iMac. It was mostly mobile. I generally just sort of basically power shut down the Mac hard and rebooted just to get back up and running for the weekend and not worry about it. Well, part of what we preach is keeping a bootable clone, whether you use SuperDuper like you do, Adam,
right,
or in my case, I use Carbon Copy Cloner. 6 on 1, half dozen the other. They're both great pieces of software. They both have the similar functions and features, especially if you pay for it. So I run that, and every month I have two different drives. They are larger than my internal drive, and I alternate with every month which one I update my clone to. So I'm, you know, have basically the previous month and the month before that, and then that doesn't even count where I'm using like CrashPlan for an offsite backup.
Sure.
And then I also have Time Machine hooked up by a USB drive. So between clones or between CrashPlan copying my stuff off, you know, out of the house, or a ChronoSync job copying stuff to the Drobo, whatever, that Time Machine basically, if I, you know, accidentally do something to a document, now I can go back an hour and, you know, get it back, whatever.
Right. Covers the oops.
I didn't covers the, yeah, covers situation. The, covers the intermittent changes between the hard backups. Right.
Sure.
So I was maintaining my clones, and these are bootable clones. So running Mountain Lion, it makes a recovery partition on that drive, as well as, of course, the one you have on your internal drive.
Right.
Well, what happened was, is I came home, and of course, it was locked up again. I rebooted, and I realized it was time to update my drive clone here at the beginning of, you know, going into the holiday for December. I updated it, and when it updated, it told me on a couple of files, inconsequential files, that really weren't important, but it did have errors reading those files, potentially bad sectors. So I waited like a week or 2 weeks and ran that way, because I guess I did this at the beginning of December. Then going into holiday, I'm like, okay, I'm home. It is time to face this. So let me see what I could do on a weekend right before the holiday. And I booted into the Mountain Lion recovery partition and ran disk utility to do a check. And yeah, it's like, okay, yeah, there are errors. And it, I mean, almost right away, it's like errors. I can't do anything more with it. You need to run a repair. And I'm like, well, I know my backups are good. I know I've got my two clones. And I hit repair. And it rendered the boot partition unbootable on the internal drive. It wrecked it because the file system was corrupted. Bad enough that I could not boot. So basically for 2 weeks, I put in my external drive clone. option booted into that drive, and I literally ran my iMac off my clone for 2 weeks. And the beauty of that is since it's a clone, it saw my Time Machine drive, crash plan was still there. Everything kept backing up and running normal. So even the changes in those files over those 2 week period were being backed up to Time Machine. So now I'm home hard for the holiday and I'm going to be here, you know, through the whole thing. So I decided it's time to, you know, face the music and see what I can do about getting the internal drive running again and get back to normal. So I reboot into the Mountain Lion recovery partition where you hold Command R as you power up and boot.
Right.
And that takes you to partition, you know. And I try one more time to do a repair. Didn't work. And at that point, I'm like, okay, screw it. So I tell it to do a I nuke the partition, the OS partition, on the internal drive because I had nothing to lose. All my data was current because my backups were good. My Time Machine was current. So it was no big deal. So I just nuked the partition.
Yep.
And I told Mountain Lion to do a fresh install. And it went flawlessly with no errors. So at that point, I'm like, well, now that I've done that, but that would mean I'd have to install a lot of stuff by hand. Why the heck not just use my Time Machine? So again, I go back into the recovery partition, you know, Command R when you boot. This time I tell it to restore from Time Machine. Point it at the Time Machine back up. Go off, run errands to, you know, last minute Christmas shop and all that stuff. 3 hours later, come home, my Mac's back up and running perfectly. No data loss. Even from the 2 weeks that I was running on the clone, because the clone was backing up to the Time Machine equally, and Time Machine saw it as the same system.
Right. That's the beauty of that.
Yeah. Nothing missed a beat. The only action I personally had to take once I did that restore from Time Machine was I ran a repair permissions to be safe. Then I ran a file system check just to make sure it was all green. And then I did have to run the combo patch updater for the latest Mountain Lion patch. Mm-hmm. Because for some reason, not that I really use it a lot, but in the notification pop-out bar, you got that click to tweet, click to post to Facebook thing and Twitter. Mm-hmm. Those would not work. And I read, you know, Googled it a little bit, and someone's like, "Oh, run the combo updater." And I'm like, "Oh yeah, let me run the combo updater." Wish I thought of that.
That's a good
that fixed my problem, and everything has been perfect, smooth, stress free ever since. My system's back up and running.
Yeah, that rerunning, the downloading, and running the combo updater is a good kind of cure all for a lot of weird stuff that can happen with your system.
Yeah.
So more than once I've told people when they've run into, hey, suddenly my machine is beachballing a lot or suddenly it's doing this or that. I've already run disk utility and repair permissions. That didn't seem to fix anything. It's sort of like, well, you asked that classic question, right? What did you install recently? You know, maybe there's a conflict there. But a lot of times people don't remember. And I think just what happens is maybe sometimes some installer or some update or something just blows away some kind of core little system thing like that.
Yeah, and then it goes to reboot and it didn't quite fix it right. And, you know, something gunks up. But the moral of this story is I practiced what I preached. I ran my Time Machine, which gave me, you know, that gave me all my changes. I had bootable clones, which I knew worked because I, you know, also test them, you know, periodically just to boot off of them just to see. And then I shut back down and reboot off the thing. And so, even though, yes, it was very frustrating that my file system corrupted, which I know pretty much it was my own fault because I was hard powering, slamming it, also equivalent, by the way, if you don't have a UPS on your machine, brownouts will kill you. So, yes, Adam, I'm going to hit you again for not having a UPS yet. How many? It was 2-3 years in a row I've beat you up on that.
Yes.
because low voltage on hard drives, those power things will cause this kind of corruption. Yeah, and problem.
Mess up your files and potentially mess up the hardware.
Yeah, potentially. And so ultimately, it enabled me to deal with a frustrating experience on my own time frame. I mean, literally, I ran on the clone for 2 weeks. Now, great, I wasn't here using it every day.
Right.
But, you know, when I was home, I just kept on using my Mac like it was no big deal, right?
Yeah, and now here's where one of those things, like I said at the beginning, you want to evaluate your backup strategy, too, at this point. Because if you've only been doing a cloned backup and you do the kind of thing that you just did where you're running off your clone for 2 weeks, well, guess what? Now you suddenly don't have backup. But in your case, you had Crash Plan, you had
Time Machine,
you had also, you know, the stuff, the ChronoSync stuff, backing up critical files. So you knew you could run off that clone for a while and still have backup.
Yeah, because my iTunes library is actually on the external RAID array unit, you know, one of these Guardian Maximuses from OWC, where it has two drives in it. And I have in the past had one of those drives crap out and literally popped it out, moved the other one into the primary position because it has a primary and secondary position, and it'll run if the secondary fails. It won't boot if the primary does, and then what you do is you just move the good one to the primary spot, reboot, and it's running. So, and they are full clones. So I literally could take that drive out, put it in a drive carrier, and fully access the data.
Right.
But so I knew that my iTunes library, everything was accessible. I knew everything on the Drobo was accessible when I booted into the clone. So really the only data on the internal drive is my home folder with my preferences and my iPhoto library and my mail. But of course, my mail is all synced. It's either iCloud or Google. You know, so I wasn't really worried about losing data. The only data I could have lost because I was doing backups properly would have been anything that changed in 2 weeks I was running on the clone. But because Time Machine kept running and grabbing those,
right,
and I did my restore from Time Machine, it's as if I never, you know, went down.
Yeah, and I mean, that's another good point for using Time Machine versus using your clone backup, because you can use...
Well, in this case, I use clone. Both, right? I ran on my clone.
Right.
But to my actual restore process consisted of boot into Mountain Lion's partition with Command-R.
Right.
Blew away the faulty partition. I let Lion do a full install just as a test. Yeah, that took a little bit of time, but I didn't really have to do anything. I just sat back and let it run.
Right.
And when it installed successfully, I felt confident about just doing my full restore for my backup. I guess I could have skipped the step. But if I'd had a glitch, I wouldn't have known if it was a file problem or whatever. I just wanted to know, right?
Sure.
I wanted to see it work. And then I just did my restore from Time Machine, and I was back up and running. So technically, the extra step of the clone, the non-Apple solution, you know, enabled me to set my own time frame of when I confronted the problem.
Right, right. Yeah, and I've done exactly the same thing. No, I was just saying, I mean, you can run, you know, and point your, after reinstalling the OS, you certainly can point the recovery system at like a clone, you know, your super duper clone, and you can restore from that.
Sure.
But the advantage with using Time Machine is, you know, your Time Machine was up to date up and to the point when you started doing your rebuild.
Yeah,
whereas, you know, if you're like me, I only run I run my clone nightly. I think you said you were running them about weekly or something like that.
So update them once a month. Yeah,
more monthly. Yeah, so you know, you potentially have some missing data at that point. So so having that second Time Machine backup gives you a lot of flexibility.
Yeah.
And if
something physically happened, then I can actually go back to my Crash Plan and pull down the extra file, you know, more current files that way, or Dropbox. You know, I do a lot of that too.
So at the end of all of it, I think the thing to remind people from this is, you know, make sure that you have a multi-tier backup strategy. Probably the easiest two to do are Time Machine and some sort of clone. You know, and then once you have those running, you know, really consider some third or fourth kind of backup, like an offsite backup. And that's how I fell into mine. You know, I started with Time Machine because I, you know, I used to not do backup, and then I did Time Machine, or I think I actually started with Super Duper because I was using Super Duper before Apple came out with Time Machine. But the minute they came out with Time Machine, I bought another drive and I added Time Machine to that. And then, you know, about a year later, I'm like, you know, I really need to get some online offsite backup. I was doing, you know, the swap drive and sneaker netting it somewhere for a while, but that's just, you know, that takes time and can kind of be a hassle, and I wasn't really diligent about doing it. So I'm like, I need something more automated. So that's when I went to the using Crash Plan, going online. And then I started doing the same thing that you're doing. I added most recently, I have a Drobo hooked up to my Mac Mini, and I run ChronoSync for just some specific, you know, real critical files. The files I use for my web development work, I get an extra backup there. My iTunes library, my iPhoto library, you know, the stuff that if anything happened to those files, I would be really devastated. My podcast files, know, that's my archive for my podcast files, because those take up a lot of space, and I can add a new drive and I just keep building them up, and I have quick access to them. I have them backed up other places as well, you know, hard copies, but that I know I can just go to the network. There's all my podcast files on there as long as that Drobo is running. And, you know, the Drobo itself has redundancy in it. So,
yep.
Yeah, good strategy. Well, great story and good ending to a story that, you know, could have gone badly if you didn't have that stuff.
Yeah, it could have been. If I had not had the bootable clone, I still had the time machine. I could have done it, but I would have been forced to deal with it right then on a weekend when I had plenty of other household chores to be doing. For the spouse and stuff like that. So that enabled me just to reboot into the clone, continue to run, time machine continued to grab any changes I made, as did crash plan. And then I dealt with it when I was ready. And then I just did the basic, you know, in a nutshell, just did a restore, wiped the partition, reformatted, did a restore from time machine, and just walked away for 3 hours, came back, and then just did one or two quick things, and I was done. It was
so
as smooth and as stress-free a DR thing, disaster recovery thing I have ever experienced in my life. But that's because I was prepared.
Yeah,
and this is the time.
Yeah, we just don't tell you to do these things. There's a reason. You know, it's like we're not just saying because it doesn't come in handy. And here's the perfect example. Well, George, thanks a lot for sharing that with us, and I think we've probably convinced a few more people that they need to get on board with this.
If we saved even one life,
we've done our job. Thanks again. And so, people, if they want to check out what you're up to, they can follow you on like Twitter or something like that.
Yeah, just George Starcher at anything, really. GeorgeStarcher.net, GeorgeStarcher.com, George Starcher on Twitter. You know, I'm easy to find.
Well, cool. Thanks, George. And hey, happy New Year.
You too.
So there you go. It's not just lip service. There is a real important reason why we do this stuff and why we kind of harp on you so much about it. It's really important, and it will pay off in the pinch where you need it, and certainly has for me in the past, and obviously did for George in that instance. And I appreciate him sharing that story with us. If you want to hear the rest of the episode where we talk about sort of cleaning up your Mac and getting your system ready for the new year, you can do that by becoming a MacCast member. You can check that out over at member.maccast.com. And I want to say a big thanks on this show to all of the folks who have become members over the past year and in years past. You really make it possible for me to do this as my job, and I appreciate that support. I also appreciate your support just subscribing to this podcast, as well as the support of my sponsors. Between those three things, that's really what makes the MacCast happen, that allows me to do these podcasts for you and allows me to have this program and the community that we've built up now over 8 years. I'm moving into my ninth year this year, and it's been a great ride, and I look forward to the next year. So just a big thank you here at the end of the year for all of that support across the board, and I look forward to the year to come. And I'm guessing you caught in that last segment that George has been on me about one part of my backup disaster recovery strategy that I have been woefully errant in following through on. And I hope to change that in this year. I can't promise that I will, but that is adding an uninterruptible power supply to my system, to my solution, a UPS. And I probably should have kept George on to talk about this, but I'm bringing it up because I got an email from someone asking about adding a UPS. He's buying a new iMac and he wants to get a UPS, which is something you absolutely should do. And the question was, well, what does it add to my system? Why do I need it? And how do I figure out, more importantly, how do I figure out what kind of UPS I need or what to buy? And as far as the research that I've done and what I understand, and I'm sure George will shoot us an email or send us an audio comment if I get any of this wrong, but a UPS is there to help protect your system during a power outage or during an electrical event where the power is going to dip down. In general, it's my understanding that a surge protector that's the kind of thing that's meant for a situation where you get too much voltage into your system, an over-voltage situation. So you get a sudden burst of power, say, from a lightning strike that's nearby or a surge in the electrical grid. That is what a surge protector is there to prevent. And it doesn't prevent against these under-voltage scenarios where the power drops or sags down suddenly. And that's where the UPS is going to come in. It's going to offer you more protection beyond just what you would get with a standard surge protector. And that's because most UPSs also have surge protection built in, or good ones should have surge protection built in. So it should cover you for both scenarios, because it's going to provide a consistent level of power to your devices, even if the power at the wall or at the outlet suffers a fluctuation. And it's not, on the surge protection side, I want to be clear, it's not necessarily going to protect against any kind of direct hit of lightning or something like that. So if you're, you know, if the lightning strikes right outside your house, there's probably nothing that you can do to necessarily protect your equipment, especially if it's big enough. But it can help ensure that you get consistent power. And during a power outage, it's going to give you time to properly and gracefully shut down your equipment. As you heard in George's story, one of the worst things that can happen is that you suddenly cut power to your device. And that's what caused ultimately the problems that he was experiencing. So the UPS is going to help you in that situation. Now, as far as how do you determine what kind of UPS or how big of a UPS do you need, there's actually, as far as I understand it, two different methods that you can use. And you don't want to use both these methods. You want to use one or the other. And that is to either look at the wattage output of the UPS or at the VA, the voltage amp or the volt amps rating of the device. The easier one to determine usually is the wattage. And to do that, all you need to do is take a look at what devices you're going to connect to the UPS, specifically to the battery backup portion, because a lot of them have battery backup outlets as well as just surge protected outlets that are not part of the battery system. So when you're looking to buy one of these, look at how many outlets for each you have. It's generally, I think, 50-50, at least in a lot of the units I was looking at. But for the battery backup, you want to add up all of the watts, the maximum number of watts that all of the devices you want to connect to it are going to draw. So that's not just what it's drawing when it's plugged in, which can sometimes be lower than the actual maximum wattage rating, but you want to look at, I have a power supply, it's pulling 85 watts. Say if you have a MacBook Pro, they have an 85-watt power supply, so it's going to be drawing 85 watts or a maximum of 85 watts, so you want to count that as 85. If you have a hard drive and it's drawing another 50, I'm just making these numbers up off the top of my head, you're going to add 50 to 85, and you're going to have 135 if I'm doing my math right. And so you'll add up all of those, and you will have a number, and that is the number that you're going to target. If you're going to look at volts, the volt amp rating, it's a little bit trickier. In that case, what you're going to do is you're going to take the voltage in volts and the current in amps and multiply those two things together for each device and then add those up. And then after you have whatever number, and again, don't interchange them, you either use watts or you use volt amps across the board. Once you have that number, you're going to want to give yourself a little buffer space. And so you want to increase that number by about 20%. Make it about 20% bigger, and that will tell you how big of a UPS you should be looking at. Now, if you want to go larger than 20%, the more you go over, that's going to give you more time in terms of the amount of battery power that you'll have to run on. But don't kind of get hung up on getting a really big number there, because the idea here is this is really just an emergency situation. You just want to have about 10-15 minutes of battery power that should be sufficient in most cases to go in and gracefully shut down your machine, finish up what you're working on, power it down, because you generally don't want to have that system on when the power snaps back on, because that's going to cause another electrical event on your system, the power sort of whomping back up. You don't want to be plugged in and running when that event necessarily happens. Now, again, the UPS should protect against that, but the idea is get everything shut down. It'll give you time. So 10 to 15 minutes should be sufficient, and most power outages don't last that long. And really, the big thing that you want to protect against is what George, I think, mentioned in that segment, is called a brownout, where the power just dips. It doesn't go all the way out, but it just dips momentarily. That is really killer on a system, on a hard drive particularly, and that can cause the platters to crash and all kinds of bad things to happen. So that's what we're looking to protect against. So just give yourself enough time to account for that. And as far as what you're going to want to connect then to the actual battery backup, you're going to want to protect your critical systems. And by critical systems, I mean almost anything with a spinning hard drive. Your Mac, for sure, you're going to want on there. And any external hard drives that are powered directly by being plugged into an outlet, you're going to want to put those on there. So count those up first, and then you can think about any kind of extra devices, things like printers or speakers or other things that you have connected to your Mac that draw power or plug into the wall. But in most cases, things like that, you can probably just plug right into the surge-protected outlets. They're not necessarily going to have to be on the battery backup-protected outlets. So you could easily go overboard, and that was one of the things I was struggling with, was I was thinking I needed to have this big, giant UPS that provided, you know, 30, 40 minutes of battery backup power, and that's really not likely what you're thinking about. What you're really looking for is something to just get you through the hump, keep you at an even, constant, good power level, and give you time to shut it down during a power outage. And so think about those things, and that's generally how you can decide what kind of UPS to buy. And in terms of brands, APC is a pretty well-known brand. I noticed on Amazon they have a brand called CyberPower. I don't know much about that company. As a matter of fact, if any of you have had experience with the CyberPower products, let us know how they work out for you, if they're a good, reliable product or not. Send us some feedback, mattcast@gmail.com, because I'm actually curious about that myself. They're a little bit cheaper than some of the APC products, and I'm curious to know how they compare. So thanks for the question on how to buy a UPS, because it was something that I was really confused about, and it gave me an opportunity to dig in a little bit deeper. So I hope that information helps you out. And I'm thinking there's a distinct possibility that George is going to add some of his thoughts to this conversation. But stay tuned for that in a future episode. Here's a little bug issue that I mentioned at the end of November, but it resurfaced again this week when I got an email from listener Greg, who has firsthand experience now with this little bug. And I'm talking about something related to USB 3.0, which is part of Apple's recently released Mac products. So the iMacs and now the Mac minis have USB 3 ports. And while USB 3 has been available on PCs for a while, and I'm sure that many PC users are already aware of this bug, it's something that is just now starting to affect Mac users. And what I'm specifically talking about is USB 3 can interfere with Wi-Fi and Bluetooth signals. And the way that Greg discovered this, or encountered the problem rather, is that he wanted an external drive hooked up to his new Mac Mini. And so he ordered up one of the really cool mini stacks from Otherworld Computing. They make this really cool stackable hard drive that's specifically designed to look like and work with the Mac Mini. And what the thing is with this product is it stacks right on top. So you put your Mini on top of it, or you put it on top of your Mini, however you want to have it stacked up, and it looks like just one kind of unit, minimizing the amount of desk space. And they have a USB 3 version now, so he wanted to get that so he would get the best performance to go along with his new Mac Mini. And what happened almost immediately when he set this up was he started to notice that his Wi-Fi signal would drop, and more annoyingly, that the Bluetooth mouse and keyboard he was using would completely die. And he'd do a lot of resetting and a lot of finagling with it and wasn't really sure what was going on. And then he discovered the article on Apple's support website, which I pointed to in that episode where I mentioned this issue, and also a couple other articles. As a matter of fact, he pointed me to a white paper from Intel that, you know, specifically states this is a known issue with USB 3 hard drives and USB 3 connections on computers. And this is just not just a Mac thing or an Apple thing. This is across the board. If you have a hard drive that offers up USB 3 and you have it particularly close to your Mac or your computer, you could get hit by this interference problem. And It sounds to me like it's somewhat of a shielding problem and issue on the hard drive as well as the computer side. Maybe both people are at fault, but it certainly is a known issue. And as a matter of fact, Greg even pointed me to an OWC video that shows you how to hack your Mac Mini to add extra shielding around the Bluetooth module. You basically have to take the whole device apart. It's a scary thing. I wrote "ack" in my show notes because it's not even something you want to mess around with. And I would imagine, as Greg mentioned in his email, could potentially void your warranty actually hacking it that way. So it's not a really good solution. The actual solution, or I guess I should say workaround rather, is to move the external hard drives further away from the computer. You don't have to move them really far, but you need to get them away from wherever the Bluetooth or Wi-Fi modules are, or where the antennas are, so they're not interfering with those signals. Well, with a product like the Mini Stack, that's really kind of defeating the purpose, because the whole purpose is it takes up less of a footprint, takes up less desk space. So I think in Greg's case, he ended up returning it and going with a Thunderbolt drive. But it does sound to me like both hard drive manufacturers and Apple need to get a little bit better with the shielding in their designs to help kind of mitigate some of these problems. I don't think it's anything that's going to be able to be fixed with any kind of software solution. It definitely seems like it's a hardware issue to me. But I wanted to point it out, and I wanted to thank Greg for giving us sort of a firsthand experience, because it does add something to consider when you're looking at an upgrade and you're considering USB 3 as a potential solution for hard drives that you might be connecting to your Mac. You may want to consider, especially if you want to have the drives located close to your computer, you may want to consider another type of connector, maybe USB 2 if it's only like a backup drive, or Thunderbolt, or even FireWire in the case of the Mac Mini, because the Mac Mini still has FireWire as a connectivity option. So just be aware of the issue and the problem, and be aware that if you're going to go with USB 3 devices, you're probably going to have them a little bit further away than you normally would other types of external drives. And then finally today, you know, what is it with Apple, and specifically Apple's iOS, that they seem to have problems anytime there's a kind of major calendar event or change? And I'm kind of specifically talking about, you remember that anytime there is a time change, Apple seems to have a problem with its alarms, with its clock system on iOS. And now this year, today, in the transition from 2012 to 2013, Apple seems to have a problem or a bug in its Do Not Disturb feature in iOS 6. I myself and many other users woke up this morning to find that their scheduled Do Not Disturb feature in iOS 6 was still on despite being past the scheduled time where it should flip back on. And I've been using the feature since iOS 6 came out, and it's been working flawlessly. I absolutely love it. I have all of my iOS devices set to go into Do Not Disturb mode at around 11 p.m. every night, and then I have them come out of Do Not Disturb mode at about 7 in the morning every morning, so that I'm just not bothered by alerts and things like that in the middle of the night that I don't want to be pestered with. And I noticed this morning when I woke up that my iPad still had the little moon icon up in the menu bar, and I thought that was really odd, and I didn't really think much of it. I went in and I went into the settings, and I noticed that, oh, under settings, Do Not Disturb, the little toggle switch was still set to on. And I just simply flipped it off and kind of went about the rest of my morning prepping some things. And then I noticed that the same thing happened on my iPhone. And that's when I began to suspect that something was going on. And then as I was going through my news feeds, I realized that I wasn't alone in having this problem. So I wanted to point it out to you, because you may not be alone in having the problem as well. You can tell if the bug has hit you if you use the Do Not Disturb schedule feature. So that's the part where you can go in and you can say turn it on and off at specific times. And if you still see the moon icon in your menu bar when you believe it should be disabled, then you likely got hit by the bug. I'm curious to see that if it's going to persist beyond just in the switchover from 2012 to 2013, if it's a bigger issue. If it is, I'm sure Apple's going to have to throw out a patch and address it. They're obviously going to have to patch it before next year if it is a yearly kind of bug. But I hope that tomorrow morning, Do Not Disturb operates regularly. But we'll find out here in a minute. But certainly, It's a bug that's out there, and many people got hit by it in the transition from 2012 to 2013. So if you did, that's what's going on, and it's not just you. And with that, that'll do it for this episode. Before I leave you, I do want to take a quick moment and thank all of my show sponsors. Circus Ponies, makers of Notebook and iTrash. You get more information on their products as well as free trials over at circusponies.com. Smile, makers of Text Expander, PDF Pen, and Disc Label. Also, PDF Pen for iPhone and iPad, as well as Text Expander Touch. Get more information on all of their products, as well as trials of their Mac applications over at smilesoftware.com. And Gazelle, a fast, easy way to get cash for your old devices, your old iPhone, iPad, iPod. Get more information on the service as well as an offer and find out what your device is worth over at gazelle.com. And a big thank you to all of my sponsors for their support of the MacCast. I have one other thing, item to let you know about, something a little bit fun. If you're in the Southern California area, or if you're planning on being in the area toward the end of January, I am a fan of Disneyland. If you watch my Instagram stream, you probably know that. I've posted a few photos, go up there every so often. And as it turns out, it looks like a lot of other Mac geeks are fans of Disneyland. I often see people checking in there. And Dave Sparks and I, Mac Sparky, were talking. He too goes to Disneyland. And we thought it would be fun if a bunch of us Mac users got together and sort of did a little informal meetup at Disneyland, just showed up there all on the same day. And so we set a date for our what we're calling our Mac Geek Disneyland Day. And it's Saturday, January 26th, which is the weekend before Macworld. I've posted a few details. We're still kind of working out exactly what it's going to be, but it's meant to be just a really informal gathering for those who can make it. And it's just a chance for a bunch of us to be in the same general area at the same time. And I've got a little invite or an event page up on my Google Plus page, the MacCast community I set up over on Google Plus. I'll have a link to it in the show notes at maccast.com. But the URL is mac@macdisney. And that's mac.at/macdisney if you want to put your name on the list there. If you can't make it, no big deal. It's just, you know, something that we're going to do. I think we have a few people signed up so far, and it really is meant to be informal. We're going to be hanging out, and I think we're going to try and get together maybe for a group photo at one point, maybe do lunch, and then if you want, you can splinter off with other Mac geeks and hang out for the day at Disneyland, or you can just go do whatever you want on your own. It's really that kind of casual. So if you can make it, wonderful. If you can't, no big deal either, and get details over on the website. And we'll have more details going up soon. And as I know more, I'll continue to let you know on future episodes. But that's going to do it for today. If you have any feedback for me, a comment, a question, you can send those to maccast@gmail.com. You can also call in on the listener hotline. That's at 281-622-4269, 281-MAC-IM-9. Also, if you need show notes, links to anything that I talked about on this or any other episode of the MacCast, you'll find those on the website. That's at maccast.com. While you're there, be sure to check out the forum at forum.maccast.com. And if you'd like to follow me on Twitter, that's at twitter.com/maccast. Also, check out the Facebook page at facebook.com/themaccast, or find me on Google Plus. There is a MacCast community there, and feel free to join in on that as well. So that'll do it for now. Until next time, I will talk to you all again real soon.